your Indle. We're actually, it's not a podcast. This is going out to the public. Here in Medford, Tufts University, Somerville, parts of Greater Boston. You're listening to WMFO at 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. We also call ourselves Tufts Educational Radio. And this show is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. And we are part of all of the above, mostly the community part, maybe a little bit of the educational part if we want to be pretentious. But really what we're here for is to talk about things that don't get talked about in the vast majority of radio shows in this country, even I would say podcasts, and that is socialism, democratic socialism, revolutionary socialism, and not just presenting alternative information. And there's good shows like that out there that present sort of a radical critique, a few of them. But we're here also to put forward how you can get involved, you know, how you can become part of the movement for socialism. And one step, if you choose to do so, is get in touch with Socialist Alternative. Go to socialistalternative.org. Go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. Go to Socialist Alternative on Facebook. We have Twitter. We have all that stuff. Mainly just start, you know, you can start at socialistalternative.org as a starting point. If you're not online for some reason, which is very rare these days, but and you can't get to the library or whatever, you could, look us up through, finding our newspaper, Socialist Alternative. You could look us up doing, we have, I'll give you like a phone number. I'll give you some other ways, the many colored ways, the brilliant ways of getting in touch with us, if I don't lose my spot here. Something else I had open to look at. I'm just thrumming through the Social Alternative newspaper. Yeah, we got the one I mentioned, socialalternative.org. We have email info@socialalternative.org, Twitter @socialistalt, Facebook /socialalternative.usa. And we have, I'm looking for that like non-digital way of getting in touch with us, so to speak, and not finding it. Oh, well. Like phone numbers. We used to have phone numbers listed, and I think we still do. Ah, there we go. Sorry, that took so long. National Office, 1027 Grand Street, Grand, G-R-A-N-D, Street, Studio B2, Brooklyn, New York, 11211. 127 10, that's the National Office of Social Alternative, 1027 Grand Street, Studio B2, Brooklyn, New York, 11211. And phone number, like here in New England, the call would be 910-639-3948. Out in Worcester, you can call 617-285-9346. And basically, there is a lot of ways to get in touch with us. And we're going to continue with talking about Trump. 1 year is enough is the title of a meeting I'm helping to organize, where we're organizing out in Worcester and I think in other places around the country. And part of the reason for having the meeting is to help publicize and build for a National Day of Action that will happen in November. On November 16th, there will be a National Day of Action drive out Trump, basically, you know, get him out of office. Now, does that mean, people say, does that mean impeachment or whatever? This isn't like a call for impeachment necessarily. It's just a call for building a mass movement strong enough to get him out, you know, get him to resign or whatever, and to put enough pressure on the Trump regime to continue to stop a lot of the things that they are trying to push, which a lot of things have been stopped by the pressure of mass movements. Everything from people shouting down the Republicans and others at town hall meetings to the mass rallies we talked about, like the Women's March after Trump got elected and many others, the DACA marches that are happening, the school walkouts around preserving DACA, etc. So around this November 16th National Day of Action Against Trump, we're talking about no racist deportations and end racist policing. These are the three main demands. Medicare for all, free reproductive care, and free public college, cancellation of all student debts. So that's actually more like six demands pushed into three, which is fine with me. I like it. If you want more information about the National Day of Action per se, which is being organized by Socialist Alternative, DSA, YDSA, Millennials for Revolution, which was formerly a pro-standards organization, etc. It's a national day of student and youth action against Trump in coordination with, like I said, Millennials for Revolution and so on, and other organizations. And there's a Facebook page for it, National Day of Action. And anyway, this is hopefully going to be happening. And it's not like everyone go to Washington, D.C. or anything. It's a go to your city nearest you or the city you're in and organize a protest on that day or a sit-in or an occupation or something. And, you know, here's one of the leaflets I have about it. It says, you know, help organize a day of action in our city marking 1 year since Trump's election. The first year of Trump's presidency has been a disaster. He's failed the people who elected him, and he's threatened the lives of millions with his vicious health care, quote-unquote, it's health care in quotes, bill. His threat to repeal DACA and the threats of mass deportation, his denial of the rights of transgender Americans, and Trump's continued attacks on poor people and workers. We've protested, we've occupied, and we've sat in. Now it's time to escalate the resistance and build a force capable of driving Trump and his entire administration out of office and fighting for a better world. Our first step, help build a nationwide day of student and youth action on November 16th, marking 1 year since Trump's election. So I hope you get involved in that. If it's happening in your area, find out more about it. Now we're having in this area, in Boston and Worcester, having meetings about November 16th. The one in Worcester that I have in front of me, check out Boston Socialist Alternative for more information on Facebook, online. For the Boston one, wish I had that in front of me, I apologize, but for the Worcester one, September 28th, we're having a meeting at 2:30 p.m. at Worcester State in the South Auditorium, and that is about you know, this what's behind the National Day of Action, the politics behind it, what Trump has been doing, how to keep the anti-Trump movement going, but also specifically about November 16th and seeing interest, if there's interest in that, and getting people involved in that, that sort of thing. Sponsored by Social Alternative and Socialist Students. Socialist Students is a student movement for the 99%. Look up Socialist Students online. And then also on September 28th at 7 p.m. at Clark University in a room called The Grind, which is near the Student Center, under the Student Center, sort of this large space. 7 p.m. Clark University, The Grind. For more information, call for the Worcester event, call, is that 508? I think it's 508-864-5006. Go to WorcesterSA@gmail.com. Go to Worcester Socialist Alternative on Facebook, Twitter at WRCSA, and then socialistalternative.org nationally for more information on the whole. A whole organizing drive and social students and so on for building a National Day of Action November 16th with meetings happening, meetings initiated before that, like here in Worcester, September, like at, in Worcester, September 28th. We're not here in Worcester. This radio show is not in Worcester. Sorry, I made it sound like it was. So I mentioned the Ginger Jensen campaign a couple times. Ginger Jensen is a member of Socialist Alternative running for city council in Minneapolis. And if you want to find out more, go to Vote Ginger Jensen. I believe that's on Facebook, but also www.gingerjensen.org. And Ginger Jensen is spelled GingerJensen, Ginger Jensen. And from the September issue of Socialist Alternative, hopefully a new issue coming out in the beginning of October, our newspaper Socialist Alternative, we have this really good article called Minneapolis Establishment on the Ropes, Time to Build a Political Alternative. I just want to read a couple quick things from it. $50 victory. At the end of July, Minneapolis became the first Midwestern city to enact a $15 an hour minimum wage. This was enacted. Now, this is the first Midwestern city. It's not the first city. When Shama Sawant was elected in 2013, the campaign prior to that focused heavily on the need for $15 minimum wage. And as someone who's participated in Worcester and other places fighting for 15, including a week I spent in Seattle trying to help with re-election of Shama, which was successful, going back a few years, let me try to put this, I'd say 3 would be a good number. 3 years, you still had a lot of people, well-meaning, nice people, arguing that, just like seem weird to them. 15, that's too much, you know, because they didn't make that yet, or they knew what the, or they knew what the, how low the national minimum wage was and so on. And a lot of times it was people, because of the people we try to organize, it was people that, you know, we're arguing against their own interests, working people arguing against their own interests, you know, and it's that's a little frustrating. You know, you want to say, why are you shilling for the bosses? Why are you shilling for capitalism and big business? Don't you understand who you are and what you're doing and how this could help you and your family and so on? But you can't do that. You can't do that. It's, you know, I don't want to name and shame people because, you know, everything they come in contact with, from their teachers to their, or most of their teachers to the, corporate media, to their religious institution, if they're religious, or to the corporate politicians, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, they're, you know, these institutions are usually putting forward pro-capitalist ideas. And if they ever get behind, like recently there are some Democrats getting behind $15 minimum wage, it's only after there's been lots of movements for it, or a mass movement for it. And there have been a lot of regionally based movements for 15. Social Alternative initiated 15 Now, which still exists, 15now.org. There's also the Fight for 15, initiated by SEIU and other unions, which we support also. And right here in Massachusetts, there's a petition drive for $15 minimum wage. And this is very something to think about. I'm going to give you two examples. I want you to think, Please think hard about these, because sometimes people act like if I support this and it's not perfect, I'm stuck with it forever. Now, this is not an argument for going for the lowest common denominator on all reforms, on all steps forward. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that there are sometimes reforms put forward that there are problems with. And with the $15 minimum wage laws, in every case I can think of, at the last minute, usually, big business, through the Democratic Party, slips in a few things that are bad, that are not good for the law, for 15, you know, whatever. So, like, in Seattle, we won 15, huge movement led by Social Alternative and others, and yet it ended up in phase-ins over a number of years, you know, rather than 15 now, like it should have been. Now, some people got 15 now, $15 minimum wage, and that was really great. And they're getting it more all the time, sections of the working class, the way the phase-ins were done. But the phase-ins didn't need to happen, right? And then there've been phase-ins, we're calling them, meaning delays in implementing 15. In every place I know of that 15 has gotten passed. Now, that doesn't mean that some people don't get it right away. They do, and that's great. But why has everyone else got to wait? And there's a big trick, a big bit of trickery from the capitalists, that they try to confuse and shave off the tipped workers, restaurant workers, people that waiters. I'm talking about waiters and waitresses and so on. People that live off very low wages and tips. And as you probably know, in the United States, both nationally and in states, tipped workers like restaurant workers the official minimum wage is like ridiculously low, like $2 or $3 or something like that, because it's said that tips will make up for the rest. Now, you have to understand, in a lot of countries, they've gotten rid of tips for the most part. And that people that work in restaurants, waiters, and so on, they get paid, enough to live on. I'm not saying it's like always a great amount, but it's more than you get with tips, you know. And it's regular. You don't have to play act all the time and whatever to get just in the hope of getting a good tip. And so the tip workers have a great interest in getting a $15 minimum wage, and a lot of them understand that. Like restaurant, go to ROC, I forget what that stands for exactly, ROC, ROC, restaurant, something, something. These are tipped workers that fight for 15, want 15, et cetera. Ginger Jensen herself was a tipped worker in a restaurant, a waiter, and she obviously led the fight. She led the fight for 15 as a member of Social Alternative, with Social Alternative and others in Minneapolis, that has been successful. But the point I was getting at, though, was that, like, here in Massachusetts, when the labor movement should have been fighting for 15, they decided to play it safe with their buddies in the Democratic Party, the labor leaders, and they went for like an $11 an hour minimum wage, which in the case of Massachusetts is even more of a joke. It's a state with one of the highest costs of living in the country. And they wanted to consciously, as they often do, water something down so low, or soak it so low with reformism and capitulation to the will of the capitalists, that they got this $11 an hour thing passed. I don't think it affected tip workers at all, I'm pretty sure. And in terms of the tip workers' minimum wage might have gone up a little bit, but it didn't eliminate the tip workers as a special category not getting the full increase. That was just like 2 years ago. You have to understand now there's a movement by some of the same people, as you know, to their credit to a certain extent, if they realize the error of their ways, but they're fighting for 15 now, and they're fighting for family leave, and they're doing a petition drive for it, right? Now, there's problems with the 15 wage law. I believe it still has the tip worker thing in, not giving them the full or even close to the full benefit of the $15 an hour minimum wage demand. And you're going to see a big battle on that against it in Massachusetts. But my point here is that if there's a reform, you have to judge, is this really not going far enough in terms of the immediate consciousness and immediately where we can win? Or is it, and therefore we're not going to support it? Or is it something that they forced us into a corner somewhat? You have to support this as a step forward, but we're going to immediately start for something better. That immediately start for something better is a big question. Is it really going to happen? Do we really have the juice to do that and so on? Because it's hard to come out against an increase in the minimum wage. You know, if you're a socialist, you know, you're like, you're for every reform that helps people, but you realize sometimes, oh, that reform, that crumb is being given because we could really get a big slice of the pie this time. They're just going to throw out a crumb here and try to make you feel happy with the crumb. Well, in Massachusetts, no one felt happy with the crumb, right? The $11 an hour thing got announced to deafening silence. And people, even getting the $11 in their checks, were like, okay, that's not enough. You know, it's just clearly not enough in Massachusetts. Clearly not enough. So here it is, less than 2 years later, I believe, there is some of the same people are being forced and pushed, meaning some of the labor leaders, to go for $15 minimum, $15 minimum wage. And that's a good thing. And same thing in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis, the trajectory of the 15 was that, you know, socialist alternative with 15 now, got that going. A lot of labor leaders joined. It was a good mass movement growing within, mass movement meaning within Minneapolis, for 15. Polling at 60%, 65%. People were really into $15 minimum wage unequivocally, right? But what happened as of November, just November of 2016, we're not going back too far, the Democrats conspired with the Republicans, and they got some Republican judges to say, no, there cannot be a referendum on the ballot. This was going to be the presidential election ballot for 15. No, it's illegal for some reason that no one in their right mind can understand or explain. Go look it up if you want. Didn't make any sense to me. You can't have 15 on the ballot, even though it's polling at 65%, even though there are people that have been working on it for 2 years before that, and even though other cities around the country are establishing $15 minimum wages or laws to that effect. And no, this is the Midwest. We're not the coasts, blah, blah, blah. The Democrats think they can get away with not supporting it. Well, they ditched it, man. They got it shoved off the ballot. No one could vote for it. But the movement kept going. We kept the movement going for 15. And it still was polling huge. It was polling huge, 65% for $15 minimum wage in Minneapolis. So you saw this turnaround fairly quick from the Democrats swearing up and down, the Republican judges swearing up and down, 15's illegal, it's not realistic, you can't do it, blah, 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 to all of a sudden, just this year, the end of 2017, that was the 1 year period, all that changed. the city council basically faced with things like there was a lot of support for Sanders in Minneapolis. A lot of new voters went out and supported Sanders. Faced with things like the polling data, faced with socialist alternative being a pain in their butt, you know, from keeping the pressure on, and Ginger Jensen playing a big role in that. She was the leader of 15 now in Minneapolis, main leader, secretary, whatever the honorific title was, I don't remember. And so they reversed themselves. The Democrats voted, the majority of the Democrats voted for 15. Now, they carved out a lot of their They put their stamp, unfortunately, the stamp of big business, on parts of the law. They didn't include tipped workers, is my understanding. And they even, like, for example, I was just out there in Minneapolis for a conference not too long ago, and our part of our conference was at the University of Minnesota. And I found out the University of Minnesota was exempt. This is a huge university with a lot of workers, a lot of students, and they don't have to pay 15. And I was outraged by that. I was outraged, and so are the obviously the people that fought for 15 out there. Anyway, just going back to quote real quick. At the end of July, Minneapolis became the first Midwestern city to enact a $50 minimum wage. The proposal will benefit 71,000 workers, overwhelmingly women and workers of color. Winning $15 an hour in Minneapolis shows another way cities can push back against Trump's corporate-backed agenda. And then they mentioned what I just described. Mayor Hodges and most of the city council resisted 15 up until a constant movement from below forced them to act. Where city councilors stood on the $15 minimum wage alongside other demands for racial equity reforms has emerged as a central dividing line in these current city council races in Minneapolis, including Ginger Jensen. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Cornel West just endorsed the Ginger Jensen campaign. That's a big shot in the arm. That's brilliant. Minnesota Nurses Association had already endorsed, that's a union, endorsed Ginger Jensen for city council, as had the Communication Workers of America, another union, and also a group called Our Revolution Twin Cities, which is the Bernie Sanders grouping that post-election, one of them, and they're big out there. And also DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, both nationally and locally in Minneapolis, has endorsed the Ginger Jensen campaign. And then under a subheading in this article I'm quoting a little bit from, We Can Build an Alternative, Ginger Jensen's independent socialist Ward 3 city council campaign stands out in the current election cycle, their election campaigns in Minneapolis. Using her campaign to escalate the pressure for 15 inside City Hall, $15 minimum wage. This social alternative member and former executive director of 15 Now is offering voters a taste of what a socialist organizer elected to City Hall could accomplish. Much like Sean Masalwant's successful socialist campaigns for Seattle City Council, Jensen's campaign is having a citywide impact and acting as a platform to amplify working class struggles. And I can testify, because when I was out there, that's already happening in terms of housing issues, in terms of environmental issues, and in terms of what's resonating from 15 being accomplished, that is out there, that is palpable, that is not everybody knows about it, but I mean it's out there to a certain extent in what you see around the city in terms of politics and what you hear about. We have the potential to build something new in Minneapolis, and that's happening now. Again, I had one last quote from this article. There's a part of the article that goes into some of the stuff I just mentioned, and then it says at the end, a majority of millennials reject capitalism, and in a UCLA survey last fall, 1 in 10 incoming freshmen said they expect to participate in protests, the highest in the 50 years since they've administered the survey. In Minneapolis and across the country, there's outrage against corporate politics as usual. By electing another unapologetic socialist to a city council, we can demonstrate the possibility of building an entirely new fighting working class political alternative, a new party of the 99%. Now, is the strategy of socialist alternative in these city council races to incrementally around the country get one socialist on a city council, then another, out of all the city councils, the thousands or whatever in the United States? No, obviously not. That's not the situation. We think, though, that to organize for socialism, there's many ways to do it. There's community campaigns around issues that may or may not end up in some sort of legislation or something. It might just be pressure campaigns. There's fighting to strengthen and democratize unions and fight for improvements for people's lives through union struggles. There's anti-racist struggle. Black Lives Matter and so on, that will fight against police brutality. We have a lot of demands around community control of the police and so on. And there's a lot of different venues or paths to fight for socialism, including just basically promoting it, like having meetings about it and informational tables and so on. We show up at the most interesting places with our socialist information. We went to an art festival in Worcester. They let us, they invited us in. We paid our little money for tabling space. And, anyone could show up. And so there we are doing our thing. And, you know, there's a few people that didn't like what we were saying. You know, they didn't like us criticizing Trump and the Republicans in the city, like Gaffney out in Worcester and so on. But then there was the vast majority of the people were open to what we're talking about. And that's the situation in the United States right now that's so interesting, is that you have this polling data I've already mentioned where certain sections of the population are majority see the word socialism in a favorable light. And then you have others that are at least willing to check it out a little bit. What do you mean exactly by that? And that's not saying everyone's becoming political or something. It's just saying that there's a larger section of people willing to look at this because of something that's happened. And the big thing that's happened recently, obviously, is Trump. You know, Trump getting elected shook a lot of people up. Because most people didn't vote for Trump. I mean, you look at the statistics of voting, and when you include people that voted for, you know, alternative candidates like Jill Stein, when you took it, which was a, you know, small number, but still there. When you look at people that voted for Clinton, many holding their noses, doing the lesser evil thing like they do so much, which we don't support, but it's out there. And you look at people that did not vote. You add up all those categories. That's not most people in the United States voting for Trump. Trump got elected, as they always do under this system of so-called democracy in the United States. They get elected with a plurality. They get elected with actually a minority of the population voting them in. Now, that still could give them a big power base, obviously, and a somewhat organized base. You'll notice Trump going around still campaigning down in conservative areas, you know, trying to invoke all the trigger mechanisms of nationalism, the flag, and coded racism and all that to keep working people repressed and keep them divided and so on. But to a lot of people, that is a call to war. That is, oh, this guy Trump, man, he's, you know, I'm talking about, like, say liberals that are satisfied with the way capitalism is and think you can have a regulated capitalism and all that kind of thing, you know, but they see things that outrage them and they fight. And I'm not trying to denigrate liberals. I mean, obviously, as a socialist, as a revolutionary socialist, I see severe limitations and actually dangers of someone that stops at liberalism. They're actually, in their own way, empowering capitalism. In their own way, they're keeping the system, helping to keep the system going if they have any power or any influence through accepting all the contradictions and ingrained injustices in capitalism that are not going to go away. They're just going to get worse. So you could say, well, I'm a liberal. I believe in capitalism, but I don't like that climate change stuff. Well, okay, well, you know, capitalism is not going to ever be able to plan itself on an international scale, sharing technologies and profit-making technologies and so on in order to stop climate change. It will wreck the environment for human habitation long before you will find capitalists voluntarily giving up the you know, short-term maximization of profit and profit rates. So that is not something that, I mean, people have tried to say good capitalism can save the threats to human existence that capitalism engenders through constant war and so on. But historically, that hasn't worked. And that's where fascism comes from and so on. When capitalism reaches its limits politically and economically and so on, and there's still a vast majority of people refusing to challenge the system, then capitalism will reassert itself more viciously. And I'm not saying Trump's a fascist. He's not. But he's a byproduct of more desperate times of capitalism internationally. Even as the economy booms, even as the stock market reaches records, this is happening. This is helping only the less than 1%. And it's actually increasing inequality and increasing tensions among capitalist rivals around the world to get their greedy hands on the share of shares of what's treasures, shares, etc., of what's happening when they do reach those milestones of another record in the stock market. You know, it's not just like, oh, nice, we another record in the stock market. It's like, well, where are we gonna shove our money now? If you're a capitalist, where are we gonna invest? Where are we gonna exploit to get that high return? That we missed out this quarter, and some other capitalist got rode the wave got lucky and rode that record wave through financial speculation or something into vaster riches. And that's what we want. That's what we want for our corporation. And therefore, we as capitalists are going to switch our investment now from what might be a profitable and even needed service or commodity in some respects to a more profitable. I mean, like when you see a business go out of business, when you see a store closed down or you see a factory boarded up, it doesn't mean the capitalists were losing money. They could maybe make huge profits, but they saw somewhere else where they could make more profits, especially the short term. That's the free market. That's laissez-faire. That's capitalism. There's no regulations that stand at the test of any time regulating capital flight under capitalism. So the capitalists can switch gears at any moment, and they can do it for political reasons too. A brilliant example that hardly anyone knows about, it's been deliberately part of the working class history internationally. It's been buried. I think I'm going to mention something in the United States. I'm not. I'm going to mention something from another country that even people in that country, because I lived there for a short time, don't even know about fully. And that's the near revolution that happened in France in 1968. Now, there's a certain amount of knowledge out there that something big happened in France in 1968, some sort of student revolt or something. Well, actually, what happened in France in 68 in a soundbite is that a student revolt led to a workers' revolt and a conscious workers' revolt where over a million people went on strike and they occupied workplaces, factories and stores and other places, distribution centers. And they not only just occupied them to say, we want a little raise, you know, we're pissed off about a lot of stuff, and they were, but not just a little raise, we want socialism. They were, a lot of them had the red flag as their symbol of the strike. They sang the Internationale, the socialist anthem internationally. They were consciously wanted a revolution and thought they were doing it. Fortunately, the leaders of the Communist Party, the leaders of the union movement there, and even some people that were radical and said they wanted a revolution, once it was presented at their doorstep, so to speak, or once it was given to them as a gift, sort of, because a lot of people didn't anticipate the movement, they got scared. They declined. The movement did not spread. Although there was a lot of unrest around the world in 68 and 69, the movement didn't spread quickly enough or coherently enough or organized enough or connected enough to other countries. So it became isolated. The leaders of the Communist Party, which also controlled the biggest trade union federation in France in 1968, the CGT, they settled for turning it into a sort of negotiation, and they won a lot in the negotiations. But workers were clearly, and youth at that time were clearly ready for more, and they were disappointed in that want, in that ready for more thing, you know, that we think we're doing a revolution, but our leaders are not most of our leaders, and that's that. And then they put all their hope. The leader said, "Okay, you're radical, but so are we, and we're gonna have this election coming up." And remember, there's this guy De Gaulle in power. Which, if you read about De Gaulle, you'll see some Trump there, Bonapartist type. You know, very try to be a man of the people. However ridiculous that was, because De Gaulle was a complete product of the elites in French society and so on. But anyway, basically you have the hopes of this revolutionary movement or pre-revolutionary movement channeled into a sort of nationwide union negotiation, which again was successful from a limited perspective. And also upcoming elections, saying, "Hey, you know, just well, based on this wonderful movement of the largest general strike in history up to that time of over a million workers, students protesting, wanting a change in the system, the enormous effect it was having on society in terms of consciousness. I mean, you'd have like impromptu political meetings and formations of groups in universities and workplaces and in town centers, and it was like the Occupy movement times 100,000, you know, in a lot of ways." And it was a strike movement that eclipsed all other strike movements up to that time. If you're sitting there saying, "What's this guy talking about? I never heard of this stuff," Ask yourself why you never heard about it. France 68. You know, go start reading up on it. Now, a lot of sources will say, it was a short-lived student revolt, no big deal, boom. Well, read a little deeper. It was the hugest deal you can imagine because it was an advanced capitalist country in the post-war upswing, which in Europe and the United States was huge, huge upswing in the economy, saved their bacon from the depths of the Depression and World War II and so on. So you have this huge, and even in the depths of this, or the heights of this post-war upswing, the vast majority of French society willing to try something new, right? But once the movement was channeled into and wait for the election, this is just a union negotiation writ large, the movement did dissipate. Although it took a while, it took a lot of repression. You know, once the for a while, the police were held in check after they beat up a lot of students and started to beat up on a lot of workers. The movement got so big that the police got scared. And they just were like, well, they couldn't do a lot, you know. And De Gaulle at one point fled the country. But when it seemed like the movement was going to be satisfied, or the leaders of the movement satisfied with a negotiation of some sort rather than a revolution, then he came back in and brought the army, mobilized the army, and sent in military to break up some of the bigger strikes and so on that wouldn't capitulate to the negotiation. And so then you had the left divided about whether to fight that or not and how to fight it, and fights became localized and episodic until the big mantra of the left leaders, most of them, was the upcoming elections, we're going to elect a socialist communist government and all will be well. Well, guess what happened? And this is another lesson of how quickly consciousness can change based on events and so on. That they didn't win. They didn't win. They won seats and so on, but it's the conservatives. De Gaulle crawled back in, although he had to resign eventually. The basic pro-capitalist conservative government got in, and people were like looking at each other that had supported the revolution or the pre-revolution and said, what the heck happened? And it was like in the United States, sort of the big chill effect kicked in, and many French average people, workers and youth that were becoming politicized, all of a sudden there was a big brake put on it and a big demoralization set in. Not fully, and this is a different country, a country with more class consciousness, more traditional left-wing politics than here in the United States. So eventually there was a socialist communist government elected in the early 1980s. And I just happened to go over there at that time because Reagan was in power here. And I'm not advocating this for Trump, but I was so disgusted by Reagan, and I was interested in France and blah, blah. So I go over there to live, and it turns out that the long arm of U.S. imperialism is longer than you'd realize. And I discovered all these things happening over there that were the direct result of the machinations of capitalism on a world scale, but also capitalism within France, where basically this socialist communist majority did get elected in an election in 1980-81. And a guy named Mitterrand, which you may remember from if you study history at all, was the main leader of this. And it started out really well. They nationalized the banking system. Did you know that? In the 80s, France nationalized its banking system. Oh, yeah, they nationalized the banking system. They started to take under public ownership, nationalization of big sectors of the economy. You might be thinking I'm talking about Venezuela. No, I'm talking about France in the early in the 1980-81-82 period. What happened immediately was similar to what happened to Chavez in Venezuela and any country that tries to challenge capitalism within a capitalist framework. They said, because again, they were nationalizing, but they hadn't nationalized all of the big corporations or anything like that. They hadn't nationalized the big agribusinesses and so on. So basically you had capital, so to speak, or the capitalist class in France say, François Mitterrand, François, what are you doing? You know, we're just going to go on strike here. And strike, what do you mean? You're capitalist. Well, there's this thing historically under capitalism called a strike of capital. It happens many times where the capitalists get their stuff together well enough to just basically say to the sitting government, we're not going to invest anymore. You think we don't pay taxes now? Wait till we don't pay any taxes. You know, and they really just threaten. They use their influence in the army, right wing, circles and so on, to even in certain cases is where fascism starts to bubble up. Say, well, you know, this is these socialists are too powerful. The only way to defeat them is to smash them through a fascist government. So now France didn't get to that point, although there were these, if you're familiar with France's colonial machinations, they had been defeated in Algeria. There were these very bitter French generals and so on about Algeria. They were ready to do a fascist coup. Even in the 80s, and that this thing is still percolating around. Look at Spain right now with the Catalonian independence movement. Look what they're doing. It's right out of Franco's playbook. But basically that the fascism was never necessary in France in the early 80s because Mitterrand and the Socialist Party, along with the leaders of the Communist Party, they decided, like they had done in Portugal in 74 after a revolution there, that was absolutely brilliant revolution, but then immediately constrained by its own leaders, they just retreated, and by the time I was living in France again, mistakenly thinking I could escape the effects of U.S. imperialism somewhat, or just not be in Reagan land for a while, they were dismantling all that. So they were privatizing the banking system. I remember seeing a parade of the newly denationalized privatized bank system promoting itself. Like, hey, we're back, you know, and that was pretty disgusting. And then I, just looked into it and saw what was happening, and there was a lot of big, riot police types walking around, and a little bit of a kind of over militarized situation. I didn't quite understand what that was about. Thought maybe that was normal, and in fact, I was told it was not. And basically, they privatized a lot of what they had taken into nationalization, and the whole thing went backwards. And Mitterrand became your typical neoliberal, ex-socialist, if you're serious about it, ex-social democrat, doing his thing like so many others in Europe did, which has led to the decline in support of the social democratic parties and new formations coming up like Podemos or initially Syriza in Greece and so on. Let's move on to Catalonia because I just mentioned it. I don't want the show to go by without talking about it a little bit. I'm going to skip over I really wanted to mention this other thing. Where did it go? This is like what I suffer from not having a laptop in front of me because I'm too cheap to buy a laptop, which is really sad. Anyway, this is also not only the anniversary of the Russian Revolution, right? 1917 to 2017, but also I've been seeing some articles appear about Marx's Capital at 150. So I like this article here. This is I think I have a little time to get into it. Marx's Capital at 150: An Unequal Analysis and Critique of Capitalism Still Relevant Today. This is from socialistworld.net, which is the Committee for Workers International website, which is the international organization that Socialist Alternative here in the United States is in political solidarity with. And it's the article starts off: the Daily Mail reacted with predictable hysteria when in May 2017 John McDonnell, now McDonnell is the second to Jeremy Corbyn in sort of leadership of the British Labour Party, which is currently going through a slight radicalization. I don't know if slight is the right word. I'm just trying to put some sort of qualifier on it so you don't get your hopes up. A lot of what I just described about François Mitterrand could probably apply to Corbyn in the future. But it is getting radicalized right now, the British Labour Party, under Corbyn's leadership. But McDonald, who's sort of second in command, so to speak, you can't understand the capitalist system without reading Marx's Das Kapital. So that would be like, say Bernie Sanders got elected and his vice president, let's say it's Elizabeth Warren or something, actually, probably wouldn't be a Democrat if that ever happened, but whatever. Let's say it's Angela Davis. She comes back out of political retirement, runs for office as an independent, gets elected with Sanders, and says, hey, you can't understand the capitalist system without reading Marx's Das Kapital. This is a public forum amplified through the corporate media and alternative media that this sentence gets out to the British public now, which is more radical than here, more class conscious. Oops. So the right wing Daily Mail and other newspapers and websites and so on tried to bury it or say how ridiculous it was. You can't understand the capitalism without reading Marx's Das Kapital, John McDonnell. When asked to merely condemn his shadow chancellor, that was the correct honorific, I said second in command, shadow chancellor. Shadow government means in British terms they are sort of, they've created their own government in opposition, ready to take power if and when an election happens and they get elected. So when asked to merely condemn his shadow chancellor, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn refused to do so, refused to condemn him, and correctly added that, quote, Marx was, quote, a great economist. Thank you, Jeremy Corbyn. That is very true. And then it goes into like the history of the British Labour Party right-wingers trying to, you know, remove socialism from a movement started in socialism. Karl Marx was widely ridiculed as an irrelevant 19th century ideologue. His predictions that capitalism would lead to expanding wealth disparity between the classes and pauperization of millions of workers were treated with derision. They still are by in some cases, obviously, in educational circles and so on. Today's world, however, reveals that Marx's prognoses are once again haunting the bosses as they seek in vain to find a way out of the ongoing damage brought about by the Great Recession of 2008, which has cost at least $12.8 trillion globally in lost output and $10 trillion in state bailouts. No surprise, therefore, that the neoliberal Economist magazine should decide to examine Marx's theories again. In an article entitled Labor is Right, Karl Marx has a lot to teach today's politicians. The Economist, of all things, points to the concentration of capital in fewer and fewer hands, the falls in workers' wages, and the explosion of the casualized Uber economy, quote-unquote, with its insecurity and misery for millions, especially young people. None of these trends, which were long ago explained by Marx, are unique to this period of capitalism. In Chapter 10 of Das Kapital, or Capital, which deals with the working day, Marx exposes the shocking working conditions and chronicles the degradation of young and old alike who are exposed to the system, who are part of capitalism, or dragged into capitalism, all in the name of profit. He shows how capitalists try to lengthen working hours to intensify the existing conditions in the workplace in their insatiable quest for more profit. Worker safety and general health are ignored as competition between companies and nation states intensify. I can testify to that. I work at Harvard University, enormously wealthy corporation, largest endowment of any university in the world, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, the endowment is not, they can use it for their daily operations or whatever they want to, a lot of it. I won't go into all the details of all their different money streams, endowment included, endowment excluded. They're making just tons of money off of in a lot of ways. And yet, what are they doing at Harvard University with library jobs, which is where I work in the library system? They're outsourcing them. They're trying to claw out increased profits in a situation where they're already making tons of profits. So they're doing outsourcing. They're doing understaffing. They're laying people off. They're, ordering less materials. That periodical is a lot of money. Why don't we not order it? Who cares about scholarship? And the faculty make some noises about it, but they're not unionized at Harvard, so that comes and goes. The union leadership at Harvard and my union is into partnership with management, so they don't care about all sorts of working conditions and outsourcing and a lot of other things that are happening. Or if they care, they refuse to fight against them in any real way or mobilize the membership in any real way. So you have this huge corporation acting as if it's about to go under by doing whatever nasty thing they can do to make more money. And this is how capitalism works. I'm not saying Harvard is atypical. Harvard might be atypical in the sense of it doesn't pay any taxes, so that helps it be even more of a megaloth or model. What's the word I'm looking for? Huge monster in terms of profit making and so on. All under the guise of nonprofit, but they make a ton of profits, believe me. The centenary of the mighty Russian Revolution beckons in 2 months. Yet it is another anniversary on September 14th. And that's the anniversary of the publication in 1867 of Volume 1 of Karl Marx's Capital. And this provided the initial theoretical building blocks for the emergence of the party, which became the Bolshevik Party under the leadership of Lenin and Trotsky in Russia in 1917, which was the successful Russian Revolution. Capital was published in 9 languages while Marx and Engels were alive. The first translation of the 3 volumes was into Russian. Eager young workers and intellectuals immersed themselves in the pages of Capital. Lenin's elder brother, for example, Alexander, read it with enthusiasm, recommending it to his younger brother, Lenin. Tragically, Alexander was hanged for an attempting to assassinate the Tsar through a desperate and misguided act of individual terror, while the younger Vladimir Ilyich Lenin read, learned, and put into practice and prepared partially what he was learning from Capital. Lenin was later to characterize Capital as, quote, the greatest work on political economy. Marx's lifelong collaborator, Frederick Engels, reviewing the book in 1867, wrote that, quote, as long as capitalists and workers have existed in the world, no single book that could have had such importance for workers has appeared. Now, Marx devoted 40 years of his life to writing Capital, and after his death in 1883, Engels undertook the task of collating and deciphering Marx's unfinished notes in what would become Volume 2, it's the Circulation of Capital, and Volume 3, Capital's Production as a Whole and its Contradictions. In their works of the 1840s, A Contribution to Critique of Political Economy, German Ideology, Wage Labor and Capital, Communist Manifesto Itself, etc., Marx and Engels had begun to formulate the basic propositions of the materialist interpretation of history and the theory of scientific socialism growing out of it. In Capital, Marx discovered the economic law of development of capitalist society. In Volume 1, he traces the history of the economic struggle of the working class, explains the role of factory legislation in the struggle, and analyzes the capitalist application of machinery. Crucially, he explains how money becomes transformed into capital as the capitalist accumulates a surplus that is invested for no other reason than to obtain a larger surplus in the next chain of production. Underpinning every assertion is the application of the dialectic materialist interpretation of the historical process to the analysis of capital formation. Marx shows that capitalist economy does not develop through a series of random individual acts of exchange, but instead is directed by specific and identifiable economic laws. He starts Capital with an examination of commodities, which are products of human labor that are exchanged, and capitalist production is, above all, the creation and immense accumulation of commodities. And then it goes into this article, which, again, I'd highly recommend. Don't have time to keep reading from it. August 14th, 2017, by Robin Clapp of the Socialist Party in CWI in England and Wales, from the CWI website, socialistworld.net. Quote, Marx's Capital at 150, an unequal analysis and critique of capitalism still relevant today. And, it basically summarizes a bit of some of the main ideas of Capital, and then, you know, talks about how then, for example, in evaluating Capital, Leon Trotsky wrote in 1940, quote, if the theory of Capital correctly estimates the course of development and foresees the future better than other theories, it remains the most advanced theory of our time, even if it's scores of years old. And then the article ends, today, as capitalism becomes more discredited, facing political, social, and economic impasse, workers around the world will once again study Capital and other works of Marxism, always remembering Marx's famous maxim that, quote, philosophers have hitherto only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. And that I thought was worth reading. We'll talk more about the anniversary, both of the Russian Revolution and of Capital. In fact, I brought in this new book that people have told me is really worth reading. It's called October by China Mieville. That's Mieville. His first name is China. He's a socialist from Britain. He's written a lot of fiction, a lot of science fiction. I've read some of his science fiction. I liked it. October, the story of the Russian Revolution, and he goes into just basically, I think, 1917, but also the history that led up to it and so on. And I hear it's really, really great. There's some pictures in it. Unlike most, and he's pro, he's a socialist, he's pro-Russian Revolution. And so he does go into how horrible Russia was prior to the revolution, which I'm really fascinated by people that critique the Russian Revolution and ignore the massacre of Jewish people under Tsarism through pogroms and terror, through the utter abject poverty of most of the people in the country, the carnage of World War I for nothing other than helping Britain and other countries increase their colonial empire. I mean, it's just like, if you think the revolution was some sort of conspiracy by a few radicals, you're completely insane. It was a mass movement. And the masses are showing democratically what they wanted through the workers' councils called Soviets and so on. Now, what that turned into later through Stalinism and so on is well documented by socialists who didn't support that. And so it's not a question of, you liked Russia via, you know, around 1970 or something, the way you're talking. No, actually. that's called Stalinism. It wasn't really communism or socialism in any way. And no, didn't like it. Don't like it. Not an alternative to capitalism. Although different from capitalism, which is another discussion. Before time completely runs out, notice, if you can, go to The Guardian in the UK, or if you speak another language, check out El País in Spain or Le Monde in France. Find some sources of information other than the corporate media in the United States, which has been doing a crap job, a horrible job, of following these huge events happening in Catalonia, which is a part of Spain, that has had an independence movement off and on for many years, hundreds of years, really, and is now, has been over the past few years moving closer to independence in various ways, and has a referendum coming up October 1st to vote whether or not the people want to have independence. And the Spanish government, it's a capitalist government, is so scared by that that they are doing, Spain for a long time was under the dictatorship of a guy named Franco, who with the help of Germany and Italy and so on, defeated a socialist and anarchist movement for a different socialism and other radical economic alternatives to Spain through capitalism in the 1930s, so-called Spanish Civil War, Spanish Revolution, and Franco and his armies coming in from Morocco smashed this government that had been elected by the people of Spain and was moving to the left. And in some places, the country had set up left-wing structures and so on. And Franco ruled until about 1975, or they had the dictatorship until, I think it was the 79. I'm not sure the exact date the dictatorship was removed. And since then, Spain has become off and on more radical, basically. But still, you have the government, the conservative federal government in Spain, has... is trying to stop this vote for independence on October 1st, or vote to whether or not to go independent, and they've been arresting activists who are just out postering, or they've shut down websites, they've confiscated ballot boxes, they've shut down meetings, they've arrested Catalonian government officials because they have their own pseudo parliament. It doesn't really have any power. For example, I heard on the little bit of corporate media I've heard about this, National Propaganda Radio today had a spokesman for the Catalan independence movement on, and they said they had passed a law in their assembly that's supposedly independent or not. Even the Spanish government doesn't call it independent. Everyone knows it's not quite independent, but it's supposed to have some power. And they passed a law saying that the corporations in Spain could not turn off someone's electricity if they were just like a certain amount of time behind in their payments. A shot at corporate rule and corporate terror over people that we could use here in the United States desperately. And the Spanish government said, no, you can't do that. Sorry. And the corporations can still turn someone's power off if they're a month late in their bills. And screw you. So that's just one of many, many examples of things that Catalonia is more progressive on than Spain. Of course, the independence movement has different trends in it. I'm not saying it's a socialist movement per se, but there are socialists supporting it, and socialists and Marxists and communists and et cetera who agree with what is a big part of the socialist movement historically, the right of oppressed minorities to the right of self-determination, including forming a state. We in Socialist Alternative and also the Committee for Works International supports the right of the Catalonian people for independence, just the same way we support the right of the people in Quebec for independence, or the right of the Kurds for independence, and so on. These are states that capitalism, through imperialism, neocolonialism, neoliberalism, etc., has exploited or kept down. A lot of places that we're taught are countries are actually different groups of people, sometimes tribes, sometimes pre-existing governments, shoved together for the purposes of whatever the capitalists want. So like in the Middle East, after World War II, a lot of countries were artificially established in order to help exploit the oil better. So anyway, watch the movement in Catalonia. Go to socialistworld.net for more information. And and social and Committee for Works National is playing a role in this, fighting for a independent socialist Catalonia, which will be a longer struggle, but we'll see. I mean, right now in this advanced European country, there is methods of fascism being used by a conservative government. It's not a fascist government. It's using the methods of fascism to try and stop a vote that was already in the cards, already worked out to happen for Catalonian independence. Anyway, we're running out of time. Thank you very much for listening to Socialist Alternative. Keep up the struggle. Find out more how to get involved. Go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook and learn about what it means to be a working person and what it means and what socialism